basically, I'd like you to first of all think about some astronaut that is on the way to the moon. Back in 1969, we made our first trip to the moon. The United States did and landed a person on the moon. Put the flag up there and saw that the moon was desolate. But as we explored, what if we had come across a computer? A functioning computer on the moon. This is crude, these drawings and everything else. But had we had done that, I suppose we would have started looking for some intelligent beings that made the computer up on the moon. Or would we have thought, I wonder how this computer just came to be randomly by chance up here on the moon? And that's basically what we're doing with evolution. So this is Romans 1:20. From the time the world was created, people have seen the earth and the sky and all that God made. They can clearly see His invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse whatsoever for not knowing God. We look at nature, and we know that there's an intelligent being. But as we're going to see, there are reasons why evolution has become popular, even though it's evident that creation takes place. We're going to look at four different things here: spontaneous generation, probability, complexity, and why. The first one, spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation, I'm just going to read this thing. Evolutionary theory on the origin of life, purposes, purposes that some 4 billion years ago, innate chemicals developed completely by chance into highly complex living single-celled organisms. This process of life coming from non-life is called spontaneous generation. According to the theory, a single-celled organism eventually evolved into all complex life forms on Earth in a relentless struggle for resources. Every evolutionary theory of life's origin is based on spontaneous generation. Now, some of you have heard about spontaneous generation in your classes. The notion that life could arise from innate, non-living matter is not a recent idea. During the Dark Ages, people speculated that rats and flies arose spontaneously from garbage. Back then, they just threw garbage out in the streets and everything else, and the pollution was horrible, and they thought it just became out of it because it mysteriously appeared when garbage was left out. Others had noticed that when meat and broths were left exposed, they became covered with maggots and microorganisms. These observations led some to believe that these life forms arose suddenly and spontaneously from non-living innate matter. Past year was the one that really killed this thing. Back in 1862, I mean, we're talking about a long time ago, this notion was killed. And basically, it says he uses glass, flash flax. He had a flask that was glass, and he had broth in it. And if you put it on a table, the broth, after he boiled it and killed everything in it, the broth would become cloudy from microorganisms falling down into the flask, inoculating the flask, and multiplying until it got all cloudy from microorganisms. All Pasteur did was very clever, a sharp man. Obviously from all he did, but he took the neck of the flask after he boiled it and he bent the neck, got it hot and bent it into an S so that even though it was open to the atmosphere, bacteria and things in the atmosphere that would fall down would fall into the neck and not be able to go up and into the flask, and it didn't turn cloudy. So he proved that spontaneous generation, this was the killer. Reddy had done some experiments before this, but this was the killer. This proved for sure that there wasn't any spontaneous generation. At least that was what we thought. He proved that microorganisms were transported through the air to the broth and not generated from the broth itself. The work of Pasteur seemingly ended the debate on the question of sudden, spontaneous origin of life. Regarding the probability of spontaneous generation, Harvard University biochemist and Nobel laureate George Wald stated, "One is only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede." Now here we're talking to an evolutionist. This guy is an evolutionist. And he's not a dummy. He's a Harvard University biochemist, Nobel laureate. I'm not even sure what a Nobel laureate means. But he's a smart fellow. And he says, to contemplate the magnitude of this task, you can see that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. He's saying it's impossible. What are we talking about when we talk about spontaneous generation? We're talking about something going from non-living to living. We're going to look at some aspects of that in a minute. Yet we are here. As a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. He's saying that basically, we have another quote from him in a minute, that he believes in spontaneous generation because he has no choice. In this incredibly twisted statement, we see that Walt's dogmatic adherence to the evolutionary theory is independent of the evidence. Walt's belief in the impossible can only be explained by faith, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We are looking at two theories, creation and evolution, that are both totally unscientific. They cannot be proven. Creation's not taking place. Evolution, the evolution says, is taking too slowly. We cannot see it. Things like the peppered moth, Stephen's right, that's all a la hogwash. There's no proof for evolution. There's no proof for creationism. They both have to be accepted by faith. And basically, we need to look at ourselves and look at the evidence and think, which do we believe? Do we believe creation or evolution? Which takes more faith? Probability. If we're going to have spontaneous generation, we have to look at some things like probability. A more detailed estimate for spontaneous generation has been made by Harold Morowitz. Now, I'm not a physicist. I'm not a mathematician. He's a Yale University physicist. He imagined a broth of living bacteria that was superheated so that all the complex chemicals were broken down to their basic building blocks. After cooling the mixture, he concluded that the odds of a single bacterium reassembling by chance is 1 in 10, what is that, 10 billion or trillion? That's a trillion. 1 in 10 trillion of one bacterium, those coming back to form a single bacterium. This number is so large that it would require several thousand books just to write it out. To put this number into perspective, it is more likely that an entire extended family would win the state lottery every week for a million years than for a bacterium to form by chance. I like that because that puts it in terms we can all grab hold of. The numbers don't mean a whole lot, but when you look at something like that, you think, wow, that's something. I don't play the lottery for a lot of reasons, but one is I never expect to win. Yes. Well, okay, let's keep that in the back of our minds, that there is a possibility chance of a bacterium forming. Even if this one cell were formed, it would require that the cell be able to, one, metabolize nutrients. We have to be able to eat things, take on water and food. Rid itself of waste. We have to rid ourselves of waste, so does every organism. When it takes things in, it uses the energy, has to be utilized the energy too, and that's part of metabolism. And then it has to be able to get rid of the waste products. And three, it has to reproduce. Now remember, this is something that was dead 1 second earlier. The term that the evolutionists will use is not spontaneous generation. They'll use the term abiogenesis. They're interchangeable. You look in the dictionary, it's the same thing. They use the term abiogenesis, which is spontaneous generation. Very, very, very slowly is what they will define it as. Spontaneous generation is non-living to living. Abiogenesis is non-living to living. The difference, the evolutionists will say, is time. Well, if you think about it, use your brain and think about it. Life had to go something in the evolutionist mind. I don't care how he looks at it, or how much time he's talking about. There has to be a period when something is dead, inert materials, and then a second later it becomes alive for whatever reason. Now the evolutionists say those lightning bolts and all the rest of it. But whatever, and the second it's alive, it has to be able to do all these things or it's going to die right away. It's an amazing statement. for anybody to believe that something could do that. That anything, no matter how simple. And when we talk about simple organisms, that is an evolutionary term. We use evolutionary terms, don't even realize it. That's a simpler life form than we are. That's an evolutionary term. You can take a bacteria that can do photosynthesis. We can't do photosynthesis. Does that make it a higher life form than we are? I mean, it's a different life form. It's a different form that God has made. But it's not higher or lower. In the 1970s, British astronomer Sir Frederick Hoyle set out to calculate the mathematical probability of the spontaneous origin of life from a primordial soup environment. The evolutionist is speculating there's this primordial soup. Applying the laws of chemistry, mathematical probability, and thermodynamics, he calculated the odds of the spontaneous generation of the simplest known free living form of life on Earth, a bacterium. Hoyle concluded that the probability of the spontaneous generation of a single bacteria is about the same as the probability that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard could assemble a 747 from the contents therein. By the way, this man became a Christian after doing this. Anything is possible given enough time. That's a statement that you will hear, as crazy as it sounds when you think about it, that is a statement that an evolutionist will make. A supposedly smart individual evolutionist will make that statement. I've read that from individuals. It's not something I'm making up. That's a quote. And that means that this ape could type the entire works of Shakespeare if given enough time. That's the same. And the entire works of Shakespeare would be easy for this guy to type on a computer compared to the complexity of one cell, of one celled organism. Complexity of structure is another thing I said we were going to look at. I've got an eyeball here. You may not recognize it right away as an eyeball. Just to give you an idea of the different parts of the eyeball, I'm not going to go into all this. There are a lot of parts to an eyeball. It's a very complex structure. Let's look at it a little simpler. Here's the iris pupil sclera. And looking at a side view, here's a little more simple way of looking at it. We got the cornea. That's the clear. You don't see it. You see the lens, the iris, the vitreous humor. Basically, what happens is light comes in through the cornea. It is between the aqueous, the lens, the vitreous humor. It is focused on the retina. When it hits the retina, then the rods and cones get the energy from that light, and the chemical reactions take place. Those chemical reactions produce electrons. Those electrons are carried like a current via the optic nerve out the optic nerve to the brain. The brain picks up those electrical impulses, flips them around, and you see. How many have seen the movie Matrix? There's a part in the Matrix that really got me. The two guys are sitting in this chair in a void, and the black guy, the big black guy, he's talking about what is reality. And he brings out the point that what we see is reality, because in the Matrix they're not really seeing what's out there. They're seeing this thing that's been programmed into them. And what we see, when I see you and you see me, we're actually just interpreting electrical impulses that are going to our brain. So, and what we feel, and all our senses that make things real to us, are nothing more than electrical impulses being sent to our brain. And if false electrical impulses could be sent to our brain, we could see things that weren't there. And that's what this guy, have you ever watched The Matrix again? Watch that part of it. It's really cool. Because he's saying, what is reality? And he brings out a really, really valid point. He's saying that what you're seeing, what you think is reality, isn't reality at all, because we're having electrical impulses sent to us that aren't real. And the eye is fantastic. It's so complex. Our brain be able to interpret electrical impulses and see is wonderful. And yet, without it all being together perfectly, it wouldn't work. This is a quote from The Origin of Species. If it could, this is Charles Darwin's book. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Well, the eye is a good example. Our kidneys are a good example. Our heart is a good example. Our body, the complexity of our body, one organ in relationship to another organ, it's an extremely complex thing, our bodies. And it all works together beautifully. Whatever system you look at, the reproductive, the pulmonary, they all work together. It all's beautifully orchestrated. And if it wouldn't all work, he's saying if you can't form this by small, numerous successive changes, the small evolutionary upward gain of things, then his theory would break down. Also, we want to just mention the second law of thermodynamics. We're talking about complexity. Second law of thermodynamics says that everything goes to randomness, the law of entropy. Nothing goes to more and more and more and more complex, but rather goes to more and more and more randomness. Also, animal instincts. Another thing that's extremely complex in our world. Animals being able to do things that we have no idea how they know how to do. Going back to breeding grounds that their parents went to that they've never been to. Doing migration flights of birds or butterflies, things that are incredibly complex, and we have no way of knowing how they do it. But it's extremely complex things that are involved in nature. And lastly, why? Why do people believe in evolution? Why did this guy Walt, we quoted earlier, I think we got him again here. Despite scientific evidence to the contrary, however, there are those who continue to believe in evolution and are therefore forced to accept and defend some form of spontaneous generation. The reason for this dogmatic adherence to spontaneous generation is eloquently pointed out by George Walt. Here it is, his quote. When it comes to the origin of life, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. There is no third way. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago, but that leads us to only one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. This is still his quote. We cannot accept that on a philosophical grounds. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. Now, here he's saying we can't believe in creation, not because of evidence, not because of science, but because of the philosophical grounds. According to Walt, it is not about discovering the truth through finding a fact. It's not a matter of evidence. It's not a matter of science. It's a matter of philosophy. Like George Walt, many people do not like the alternative that all life on earth was created by God. So as Walt said, they are willing to believe the impossible. Since the impossibility of spontaneous generation is a conclusion that leads to a supernatural creative act by God, it is a conclusion that many choose not to accept. It carries with it what are felt to be in the present politically correct climate, undesirable philosophic and religious implications. It is for that unfortunate and illogical reason most scientists continue to cling to the unscientific, disproved theory that life arose from non-life through spontaneous generation. So that's all. Read that underlying part again. It carries with it what are felt to be in the present politically correct climate, undesirable philosophic and religious implications. If you don't believe in evolution, you've got to believe there's a creator. Why do people fight to keep out creation in schools and say evolution must be taught as fact, not theory? I don't know if you've heard much about this lately, but a school board will say we should have evolution taught along with creationism. They're not saying throw out evolution. They're saying teach them as both theories. And it will be like the next meeting, there will be people in there screaming and hollering, having a blooming fit because we're taught about teaching creation on the same foundation as the theory of evolution. And they'll be screaming and hollering that evolution is not a theory, it's a fact. The reason they're fighting so hard for evolution, if they really, you know, if we're just evolved animals, if we're just another evolved animal, then why fight? What does it matter what anybody believes? It's the reason. It's not the theory of evolution. It's what it allows or allows people to do. If evolution's true, there's no need for God. There, if evolution's true, that's my wife. Just ignore her. If evolution's true, there is no sin and no need for a savior. If evolution is true, there is no hell. Now this is a biggie. There is no hell. There's no basis for moral values. Adultery, homosexuality, fornication. In other words, you're free to do whatever you want. We as humans, we like that. I like that. Everybody wants to do what they want to do. If you look at God's law and man's law, they're totally opposed. God says, be pure. Man says, pleasures of sin for a season. God says, store up treasures in heaven. Man says, store up treasures here on earth. Everything you think about in the Bible, God says, be humble as Christ was. Man, do we love having our egos pumped up? All of us. I'm talking about every one of us. This is our human nature, our sinful human nature. And what evolution does is it cuts your tie with God. We don't have any tie with God. We're not created beings. We're just evolved animals. We can do whatever we feel like doing. If you feel like doing something that doesn't hurt anybody else, do it. Whatever it means. Consequently, life has no purpose. Animal rights make sense. That's a big, you know, you some of these people, you think they're nuts. They will, I read an article, I think I mentioned in one class earlier this year, I read an article, it was in California, which you could probably figure. But this was several years ago where a guy was thrown in prison for several months, fined $1,500 for killing a rat in his garden. And that sounds crazy. It sounds crazy to me. But if we're just an evolved animal, then every animal has the same rights we do. So just like you can't go out and kill somebody, you can't go out and kill an animal because he's got the same rights you do. Your horse, your dog, they got the same rights as you do. We're not made in the image of God. We're just an evolved animal. So animal rights make sense. That's why animal rights have become so popular, because of evolution. And the Bible is unreliable and Christianity is false. You're a free individual. Now, the Bible says that the pleasures of sin. It does say, the Bible says the pleasures of sin. It doesn't say the supposed pleasures. It says that sin's pleasurable, but it says it's only for a season. You pay the consequences. And so, this is why they're fighting for it. Because man is not responsible for his actions. Evolution is a way to escape his responsibility to God. That's a big thing. Let you do what you want without any guilt. Do we put our faith in the word of all-powerful God who knows everything and has always been there? Or do we place our faith in the words of fallible humans who don't know everything, who haven't always been there, and whose values and subjective thinking lead only to fatalism? And that is the two things I want you to think about as you go into high school, college, through life. Think about the difference between creation and evolution. There's a huge, huge gap between them. And Satan wants all of us to believe evolution, to throw God out of the picture. But it's not possible.